Hello, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, fellow travelers along the way. Welcome to another episode of the Avalon Mentors Podcast. So in this episode, I'm continuing what I began in the last episode about sacred geometry and about scholasticism and the scholastic collapse. I talk about here the seven liberal arts and what they actually mean. And I talk about what happened in the struggle between the nominalists and the realists that was then ended in 1277 by the condemnations of Paris. All these events that happened so long ago for us still have meaning and relevance for us today, still impact a great deal of what we go through today. So if any of this interests you, I look forward to having you here to be with me on the show and enjoy. Okay, so there's this system of thought, which is esoteric mathematics, sacred geometry. And it is a system which the medieval era inherited from the Greeks and the Romans and from the Egyptians and from even before that, and back, way, way, way back to Neolithic times. And it's a system where human beings can have access to the divine creator of the universe through the study of the interplay of these numbers that represent actual concepts, angels, powers. And this interplay, this great pattern of thought, they referred to it as what was called the Logos, translates as the word, although that's not an accurate translation. The Logos in Greek was that great pattern, that great quilt, that great tapestry of numbers that worked with one another in a constantly shifting mode, but always going back to the same basic structures, what Plato called the eidoi, or the forms. This logos John translates as the word, as in en arche ho logos estin, in the beginning was the word. And in Christianity, that word became flesh and dwelt among us. In other words, the incarnation of Christ himself is the incarnation of this pattern, of this logos. So things like philosophy and theology were actually attempts to understand this logos. They were attempts to work out the interplay between these mathematical powers or figures in that great tapestry that constituted the logos itself. There's a great book on this attempt to work this stuff out called The Liberal Arts Tradition by Kevin Clark and Robbie Scott Jain. And basically, Clark and Jain talk about how the liberal arts, which developed primarily in the medieval era, were an attempt to study the roots of human existence itself. Now, the liberal arts, the scholastic thing, essentially were seven in number. There were the quadrivium and the trivium, okay? The trivium came first, and that was grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Grammar was learning the language of the thing, whatever the thing was, but in this case, it was primarily the language of mathematics. Like, what is a two? What is a three? How do these things add up to each together? Then the logic was how do things connect one with the other? And again, this was the study of geometry, of how do these things connect one to the other. And then you have rhetoric, which was how do you make the thing beautiful? How do you make it attractive to others? And rhetoric was primarily how do the various geometric forms fit in a great scale of a logos? And that was the introduction to the quadrivium. The quadrivium, and I always get this wrong, so you'll have to bear with me. You can look it up yourself, but the quadrivium was primarily, calculation, geometry, music, and astronomy. I think that's right. Hope I got that right. And all of those had to do with mathematics. because, you know, that was what they were studying. Now you say, why mathematics? Why were they all mathematics? Why not like history? Why not poetry? Why not political science? Well, those things weren't what were important to these people. They were things that you did after you had your education in the liberal arts. And the liberal arts was primarily for priests. It wasn't really designed for laymen. Not many laymen engaged in the liberal arts. Why? Because the priestly class of the medieval era saw that mathematics and the study of mathematics was really the study of the divine. And since they were the clerics, they weren't just there in order to keep order in their parish and to marry people off. They were there in order to contemplate the mind of God. So their study was the study of Christ, the Anointed One, the incarnation of the Logos. And in order to study Christ, the Logos, they had to study mathematics, because that's primarily where, you know, he was located in the medieval mind. Clark and Jayne point this out. This is on page 6 of this excellent book. According to Aristotle, scientia is a body of knowledge justified by reason which can be in the mind alone. But an art is imitation joined with reason, or a science joined with practice. An art is, in short, a skill. So the liberal arts are the 7 unique skills used to create and justify scientia, knowledge. So you study the arts in order to gain the scientia. You study the techniques in order, the skill, in order to be able to gain the knowledge. So if you wanted to gain a knowledge of Christ, you had to study the skills that would get you there. And the skills were primarily mathematics. Why? Because, again, Christ, the Logos, was primarily a mathematical concept. In order to see the vastness of this Logos, the immensity of it, you had to work your way up. It's not something you can just get like that. So they said the arts of the trivium then were grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, and they were the tools of language. The arts of the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music, are the tools of mathematics. I got it right. Not calculation, but arithmetic. But then geometry, astronomy, and music. They are the tools of mathematics. I argue that both are the tools of mathematics. You know, they came across as something different. Okay. So then they talked about how philosophy is based on this arts of the trivium and quadrivium. And the trivium and the quadrivium led to philosophic thought. But philosophic thought really is an extension of what they were originally trying to do. It's putting the mathematical argument into local language, namely Latin in that case, but later in English. Clark and Jayne write here further on in the same chapter. The 3 philosophies of natural, moral, and divine would have contained all the subjects and disciplines of a contemporary university, though they would have been geared toward justified knowledge, science, not application, technology. Okay, so natural science, moral science, divine science, which is theology, were all something that you studied after you had done the liberal arts. And they were another way of looking at that same thing. And the ultimate goal, as Clark and Jayne point out, was piety. They were trying to get their students towards piety. And what is piety? They define it here as piety signifies the duty, love, and respect owed to God, parents, and communal authorities, past and present. Piety was the end goal of education. Piety shapes our being and identifies who we are. It is the virtue which admonishes us to do our duty to our country or our parents or other blood relations. And lastly, penultimately, piety for the ancients and for Calvin suggested a faithful devotion manifest in one's actions, piety in word and act. This devotion was not merely an emotional commitment to God or one's elders. It included the subjection of one's will and the patterns of one's life. Subjection to the pattern itself. The idea being that once you had seen the immensity of the Logos and how it fits together, you put yourself as subject to that. You put your hand under the foot of the Logos, so to speak. You make yourself the servant to wash the feet of the Logos. The whole point was that you committed yourself to a greater thing than yourself in order to expand the higher angels of your spirit and subdue the lower angels, the demons of your spirit. Just like the ancients used to say. See, that's what I'm pointing out. The ancients used to suggest that mathematics and the esoteric mathematics was a way of converting the human spirit from the low to the high. And that's what they were saying. Clark and Jayan are saying the liberal arts was designed to do. It's supposed to instill piety. And lastly, true piety consists rather in a sincere feeling which loves God as Father, as much as it fears and reverences him as Lord, embraces his righteousness, and dreads offending him worse than death. And whoever have been endowed with this piety dare not fashion out of their own rashness any God for themselves. Rather, they seek from him the knowledge of the true God and conceive him just as he shows and declares himself to be. And that's a quotation from John Calvin's first catechism, from Calvinist thought. Yeah, so piety ends up being a proper love and fear of God and man. So the whole mission of education was to instill this proper fear of God and love of God and man. So piety was the end goal. You can say the conversion of the human spirit from the lower to the higher. So esoteric mathematics was designed to do that. And the way that it did was by showing you from small to great how everything fit together into a harmonious whole, a grand harmony der Welt, as was pointed out here by Johannes Kepler. That harmony der Welt was something that you entered into, and it made up a comprehensive whole, and everything worked out just fine. So fine, as a matter of fact, that you'd be a fool if you suggested that there was no God. See, if you were somebody who was atheistic, you'd be a fool, as is pointed out, actually, by one of the scholastics, St. Anselm of Canterbury. And St. Anselm had a famous aphorism or famous argument in the Proslogium. It was roughly around 1100s that he wrote the Proslogium. And here in Proslogium 3, he creates what's called the ontological proof. He says, truly there is a God, although the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And so, Lord, do you, says Anselm, who to give understanding to faith, give me so far as you knowest it to be profitable to understand that you are as we believe, and that you are that which we believe. And indeed, we believe that you are a being than which nothing greater can be conceived. Or is there no such nature, since the fool has said in his heart, there is no God? But at any rate, this very fool, when he hears of this being of which I speak, a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, understands what he hears. And what he understands is in his understanding, although he does not understand it to exist. For it is one thing for an object to be in the understanding and another to understand that the object exists. Okay, he says, even the fool is convinced that something exists in the understanding, at least than which nothing greater can be conceived. When he hears of this, he understands it, and whatever is understood exists in the understanding. And assuredly that than which nothing greater can be conceived cannot exist in the understanding alone. For suppose it exists in the understanding alone, then it can be conceived to exist in reality, which is greater. Therefore, if that than which nothing greater can be conceived exists in the understanding alone, the very being than which nothing greater can be conceived is one than which a greater can be conceived. But obviously, this is impossible. Hence, there is doubt that there exists a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, and it exists both in the understanding and in reality. That's St. Anselm, a watertight argument in the Proslogion. God is that which then nothing greater can be conceived. And if we can conceive of God, he has to exist because that's greater than our conception and therefore must be. So only a fool would say that God does not exist. This begins to go into what happened in the 13th century. Remember that the whole structure of the medieval world had inherited this esoteric mathematics, that the Logos was real, that God was real, the creator of the Logos was real, that Christ was real, that these mathematical things could be understood by human beings, and that by studying of these mathematical things, we could come to an understanding of God himself. And when we come to that understanding, only a fool would then reject the existence of God. That's St. Anselm. The fool that he's talking about, the fool that he's talking about is one Abelard. Abelard, as in Abelard and Heloise, because he had a long correspondence with a woman named Heloise and actually had an affair with her, and et cetera, et cetera. Abelard was one of the greatest thinkers of the scholastic era, and he was one of the granddaddies of nominalism. Okay, so here's where we get into this. What Abelard was suggesting was that there was no God. That's what Anselm says. And Abelard is a fool because God is this way. So Anselm is taking what is essentially a mathematical structure and he's putting it into words, into Latin, and translated here into English. But he's trying to wrestle the idea away from Abelard that there is no God and to suggest Abelard's a fool. To suggest that there is no God. Well, Thomas Aquinas actually responds to Anselm in the Summa Theologiae. Thomas Aquinas, as is pointed out in Scholasticism, was one of the few minds that could have reconciled the problem that was beginning to emerge. Unfortunately, he died, and that was the end of that. Aquinas, though, in the Summa Theologiae, dictated to his students who wrote down his thoughts and put them into the structure of objections and on the contrary and so forth. He put into Article 1, this is from the Summa Theologiae, Question 2, the existence of God, Article 1, or Article 2, is that right? No, it's Article 1, the first article, okay? So the existence of God, Question 2, Article 1. Now keep in mind, what Aquinas is doing is he's responding to Anselm, but he's also doing something very similar to what Euclid did with his mathematical proofs, which is to explain the cosmological system that corresponded to mathematics. Okay? Euclid was expressing the mathematical system in a series of proofs. Aquinas, to a certain degree, in Summa Theologiae, is expressing the theological truths that are connected to the mathematical system. This is important because we're going to look at what Abelard actually is suggesting in just a minute. Aquinas says, Anselm, you're wrong, and here's why. Okay, he says, no one can mentally admit the opposite of what is self-evident. As the philosopher, Aristotle, states concerning the first principles of demonstration. But the opposite of the proposition God is can be mentally admitted. The fool said in his heart, there is no God. Therefore, that God exists is not self-evident. See, Anselm had said it is self-evident. You can't say that God is that which then nothing greater exists only in the mind. He has to exist in reality. Otherwise, right? That which then there can be no greater is not actually the greatest. And it's self-evident, therefore. Aquinas says, no, it's not self-evident because, here's why. A thing can be self-evident in either of two ways. On the one hand, self-evident in itself, though not to us. On the other, self-evident in itself and to us. A proposition is self-evident because the predicate is included in the essence of the subject. As man is an animal, for animals contained in the essence of man. If therefore the essence of the predicate and subject be known to all, the proposition will be known to all, the proposition will be self-evident to all. As is clear with regard to the first principles of demonstration, the terms of which are common things that no one is ignorant of, such as being and non-being, whole and part and such like. If, however, there are some to whom the essence of the predicate and subject is unknown, the proposition will be self-evident in itself, but not to those who do not know the meaning of the predicate and subject. of the proper position. Therefore, it happens, as Boethius says, that there are some mental concepts of self-evident only to the learned, as that incorporeal substances are not in space. Therefore, I say that this proposition, God exists of itself, is self-evident, for the predicate is the same as the subject, because God is his own existence. Now, because we do not know the essence of God, the proposition is not self-evident to us, but needs to be demonstrated by things that are more known to us, though less known in their nature, namely by the effects. So in other words, in order to understand that God exists, we have to start low and work our way up. And the existence of God is not evident until we work our way up to the top. Now he goes on to suggest that one of the examples might be that a triangle is an object with three sides. That is self-evident, right? A triangle is a thing with three sides. It's self-evident in and of itself. But here's the problem, and he acknowledges that this is the problem that Abelard brings up. A triangle may be an object that has three sides, that's self-evident, but it's not self-evident that the triangle has any connection to anything beyond this world. Okay, that's where the problem lies. Anselm misses this. Abelard brings this up. You see, what had happened is that most of the system of esoteric mathematics, which is what all of this philosophy and theology is based on, grew out of the writings of Platonic thought and the carryover of Platonic thought into the West. And that's primarily what's called inductive thought. That is, here's the system, now we induce from that all these other propositions. But it's held as a given that the thing we're talking about has reality. It actually exists. Plato held it as it actually exists. All the ancients held it as it actually exists. We're not just talking about numbers here, right? We are talking about something that we can't fully see or comprehend, that we work our way up to understand, and we're talking about it in a pure language of mathematics. And it's a glorious system, and it's a beautiful system, and we accept it and we go with it. And that was the Platonic way of thinking. Sometime in the, I think it was 800 or 900s, a whole new body of work was introduced to the West, and that was the work of Aristotle. And again, this is outlined in Scholasticism by Joseph Pieper. And Aristotle's works were introduced where they had not been introduced to the West before. There were only a few works that were complete of Aristotle, not many. And so he was really kind of sidelined and ignored in favor of Plato. But Aristotle's works don't operate inductively. They operate deductively, and that's different. Inductive reasoning has, here's the principle, and this is what we derive from it. Deductive reasoning says, look around you and see all these things, and we abstract and come to a conclusion. See, that's deductive reasoning. The one goes this way, the other goes this way, if you will, if you want to look at it as a geometric thing. It was like two triangles that are interlocked with one another. Like this. Kind of like the Jewish star, as a matter of fact. That's not coincidental. The Jewish star of David. Heaven descends to earth so that earth can rise to heaven. And that was the idea of most of the incarnated imagery, was that Christ came to earth so that man could rise up to heaven. Well, with the introduction of Aristotle, it hit the Western world like a tidal wave. And how it happened, you can read about that in Joseph Pieper's work. Essentially, it was lost to and existed in the Muslim world and came back around through Spain, but that's a long story. Aristotle's major works, I think it was the Ethics and the Physics and the Metaphysics, all were reintroduced to the West. And they were very powerful works, so powerful, especially with the commentary by the Muslim commentators. So powerful were they that they were incorporated by these men who were working in the universities to revivify all these great works of culture. They were used by the men as a template for how to think and how to study. And the more they studied them, the more they found
that this guy understood a heck of a lot, and he has no reference to the Logos. He has no reference to this system that Plato was expounding. How can a man be so right and so accurate without reference to that system? And this is where Abelard came in. Abelard was so good at being able to assimilate Aristotle's works. And Abelard began positing the following idea. Maybe we don't derive our individual thoughts, our accidental thoughts, from a universal concept, constant. Maybe that's not the way things actually are. Maybe we derive the understanding of a universal constant by the accidents that exist, the individual things that exist. In other words, we abstract from the world to create a universal thing, rather than having a universal thing manifesting in its individual species, its individual instances. And this may be even true for mathematics. So to put it in layman's terms, in the Platonic esoteric mathematic system, mathematics is a language for understanding something that exists beyond our world. And we see it manifest in the individual things of the world, human nature, architecture, the natural world itself. In the Aristotelian way of looking at things, and what Abelard suggests, is maybe we look at the natural world, architecture, the human person, and we abstract from those things and we make a universal in order to understand the world better. Now, neither the one group was called realists and the other was nominalists. The realists were those that said this has connection to something real beyond this world. The nominalists were those who said this was in name only that we created these universals. In the realist camp, everything, culture and society and religion and philosophy and theology, were all based on this idea of the Logos, that it had connection to something beyond this world. But Abelard was suggesting something that was equally powerful. That is, maybe these things of culture and architecture and art and mathematics and religion, beautiful as they were, are nothing more than humanity trying to deal with the world, trying to cope with the world. The two together create, as Pieper suggests, an explosive union, one with the other, because the one is faith and the other is reason, right? The one is the masculine and the other is the feminine. One is the square, or one is a circle and the other is a square, trying to unite them together. If you're uniting the two together, then you have an explosive, powerful thing that's going to just generate. I mean, phi goes on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. It's an unending number. If you separate one from the other, you have a big problem. One separated from the other dominates. So if you separate faith from reason, if you separate the circle from the square, all of a sudden they grow in without relationship to another, without the other to keep the other in check. And what happened in the Western world was that in 1277, this debate was going on and on and on, Archbishop Tempier, who was the Archbishop of Paris, saw there was a problem cropping up in these universities, and he considered it to be heretical to be suggesting things like what Abelard was suggesting. And so he said, no more. You will not teach the following things. This, 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 this. And those things that he listed as you will not teach were primarily Aristotelian ideas, although some of Thomas Aquinas' ideas were on there, as were many of Peter Abelard's ideas. You will not teach these in the university under pain of censure. There's a truck. Under pain of censure, under pain of being thrown out of the university, under pain of, I don't know, death, heresy, you know, whatever. But it was a severe stricture on the political and philosophical and intellectual climate of the West. And when Tempier made those condemnations in 1277, he essentially said, this camp is no longer welcome here. well, what happened? All those guys were suddenly without a job. They were without the ability to continue in the universities. And so they fled Paris and they fled England as well, Oxford, because Oxford followed suit with Paris. Where did they go? They went to Germany primarily. And they established new universities and they joined with some universities that were already there because Germany didn't have a lot of universities before that time. And one of the major universities that they founded was Wittenberg College. Okay, Wittenberg College. Those nominalists fled to Germany and founded Wittenberg College, among others. What does that mean? It means Wittenberg became a seat of nominalism without realism. And like I said, as soon as you have one without the other, one grows cancerously because it doesn't have the other in check. So nominalism grew in Germany, in Wittenberg, like nothing else. And if you have one without the other, realism without nominalism becomes totalitarian, dictatorial, doctrinal. That's kind of what happened in the West as we moved to doctrine rather than understanding and the attempt to convert the individual soul to its higher angels. And nominalism without realism becomes materialistic. It becomes, again, power, right? The struggle for power, the struggle for reason above all else. And what happened in the West, but this rise or ascent of reason alone, intellect alone, without the connection to the Logos. The one without the other became cancerous. And in the West, the rise of nominalism was the rise of the modern world. This is the collapse that is talked about in The End of the Modern World by Romano Guardini, because Guardini says the modern world started in 1277. It started with Archbishop Tempier saying, no more, and the split, and the cancerous growth of nominalism. Because nominalism basically says, all these numbers and all this system and all this calculation that you do and all the interplay of these things, that's beautiful, but has no connection to anything beyond this world and is utterly useless, therefore. What is a two? What is a three? What is this golden proportion you talk about? There's no connection beyond this world. We made it up. At best, it is a map of how the human mind works, but there's nothing beyond the human mind. There's no soul sauce. There's no realm beyond this world that we call heaven or hell. There's no God. There's no logos or pattern. There are no angels or powers. It's all purely human invention. And when it's all purely human invention, materialism, right? The world is a prison. It's a materialistic prison. It's a trap, as Admiral Akbar might point out. All you're left with is a material world. And in that sort of material world, what's the best thing to do? Improve our physical lot? Dominate over others? Make as much money as you can. So the rise of technology and eventually the Enlightenment that occurred, the political rise to power and individual fame and seeing humans as machines only to be dominated over, and the political thing, right? Political power. Nominalism became a cancer in the West, and we went down an intellectual route where mathematics became good for building bridges and counting chickens and knowing how many troops you can send into the other country through the forest of the Ardennes. That was the primary role of mathematics, you know, to calculate how far you could lob a missile so that it hits the enemy with a gas shell rather than your own troops. But no longer did mathematics have connection to a logos or a thing beyond this world. And no longer did mathematics remain as a converting tool for the individual soul to its higher angels. And that also had effect on every other thing, because remember, every other thing up to that point was a reflection of this mathematic infrastructure. This vast thing of the logos was reflected in literature and philosophy and theology and politics and religion and religious art and architecture and music. Everything of human culture related back to this. It was the underlying bones of human culture, not just Western, but Eastern, Mesoamerican, all of it. In the West, it fractured in 1277, so much so that we're still dealing with the fallout even now. And when that fracture occurred, words became nothing more than human sounds made by the tongue, or written ink on a page. And at that point, music became nothing more than jarring sounds. At that point, or something to entertain princes. At that point, architecture ceased to be based upon beauty and harmony, and you know, which are themselves a mathematical extension, and became nothing more than shelters. And sometimes shelters in order to beat people down, like brutalism that develops in the 20th century. So it was really the collapse of 1277, the collapse of the medieval world, the scholastic world, as Romano Guardini points out, that was the cause of the beginning of the end of the Western world, the beginning of the collapse of the Western world. And that collapse in the scholastic world, I maintain, was a mathematical collapse. It was a pulling out the rug from under any reason why mathematics might be important, aside from power and wealth and, you know, entertainment value, I suppose. So when we look at Hamlet, right, we have to think about Hamlet, because that's written in, you know, 1600, 1603. When we look at Hamlet, Shakespeare, who I believe, like many artists, was at least introduced to this idea of esoteric math, because it does continue. It does even now continue. There are some, Randall Carlson, for instance, Robert Lawler, for instance, Mitchell, who carry on this tradition, but they are isolated, they're few and far between, and they're often seen as freaks or as wizards or as magicians that should be avoided, you know, because that's too new agey or whatever. The tradition was carried on, but it was no longer mainstream, and such people no longer had the ability or the positions that were creating of architecture. That's why we get these ugly buildings that crop up for businesses everywhere, and that's why we get hideous churches that look like dentist's offices, you know, and that's why, for instance, we get music now, which is auto-tuned or completely unlistenable. That's why all these things now are the way they are, because the people that used to see them as connected to a mathematical harmony of the logos no longer have the positions of power and influence that they used to have. In their place are people that see numbers, mathematics, as nominalistic, and therefore the only thing that such things like art should do is to maintain power over others, to manipulate or dominate others, to force others to your will, to make as much money as possible. A nominalist viewpoint. Now, I'm not saying that nominalism or realism is the answer to the universe. What I'm saying is that before 1277, they were united together in a constant conversation with one another over the very nature of mathematics. And what is it that we're talking about when we talk about mathematics? That was their conversation. When they split, we got nothing but words, 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 and this terrifying, debilitating, emasculating fear that maybe, despite our reason, there may be something beyond this world of terrifying, brutal performance. An undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns, something to be dreaded rather than loved, something to be avoided as much as possible and feared like you fear a ghost, rather than something to be embraced and longed for the way Plato or Socrates longed for death. That concludes another episode of Avalon Mentors Podcast. Thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed the show, would you kindly thumb the like button and also give the show a positive review on whatever platform you're listening on. Until next time, cast off the works of darkness and put upon you the armor of light. So long.